Okay, well, I apologize slightly that I'm going to give a real string theory talk here. So I feel a little bit out of line. But it isn't really a real string theory talk, because most of it is about Yang-Mills theory, as you'll see shortly. What I'm going to talk about is a summary of some work which I did with Charlotte Christiansen, Jan Plefka, and Matthias Staudacher. It was motivated by a very nice recent paper by Berenstein, Maldacena, and Nastasi, and has huge overlap with a few other things that also appeared in the literature at about the same time. What it's about is taking a certain limit of the ADS-CFT correspondence, and the question I want to answer after describing to you what this limit is why the limit is interesting. I will have very little to say that's quantitative here. Why it's interesting is more qualitative than quantitative, but as you will see, it is indeed possible to learn some quantitative things. Not everything about this is understood. In fact, there are some very interesting and probably accessible questions here, very basic and interesting questions about string interactions and things like that, and computing string interactions using Yang-Mills theory, things that will be ironed out in probably in the very near future. So it's an interesting thing to work on. So let me begin. So yesterday, George Savitty gave a very nice summary of why one would expect that there is some sort of a string theory dual of a strongly coupled gauge theory. In fact, that's a sort of long-held dream of particle physicists, that QCD, at least in its strongly coupled regime, could have a dual which is some sort of string theory. And there's even a limit of QCD, the so-called large N limit, where that string theory is weakly coupled. And maybe one could use it to compute things. And the computations you'd be doing there are things like about how the hadron spectrum emerges or how nuclear forces come from QCD. So they would be QCD in a very important dynamical regime. However, this problem has been there for many years, like about 30 years, with not very much quantitative progress, at least. And within the last 5 years or so, string theory has actually finally yielded one explicit example of this duality, and that's the one contained in the Maldacena conjecture, or the collection of ideas that are more or less called ADS-CFT correspondence. What the correspondence is a statement, first of all, the Maldacena conjecture, of an exact duality between a gauge theory and a string theory. The gauge theory, of course, isn't QCD. It's a more symmetric one. In fact, it's as symmetric as a four-dimensional gauge theory can get. It's N equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, whose Lagrangian I've written down here. And it's supposed to be exactly dual to type 2B superstring theory on a particular 10-dimensional background. That 10-dimensional background is a direct product of two 5-dimensional spaces. These are both maximally symmetric 5-dimensional spaces with constant curvature. One is a 5-sphere, and the other one is ADS-5. One has constant positive curvature, the other one constant negative curvature. I've drawn it very schematically here with many dimensions suppressed, but you should imagine it looking something like this. The parameters of this space are two. One is the radii of curvature of these two spaces. That's this radius. It's given in terms of the string coupling at n, which I'll tell you about in a second, by this formula. The other is the Ramond-Ramond four-form flux, which you get by integrating over the phi-sphere, the exterior derivative of the Ramond-Ramond four-form in type 2B and that equals this integer n. So in a sense, n is quantized if it should be some integer. We'll usually consider the case where it's a large integer. Given g string is fixed, then in some sense the radii of these spaces are quantized. The mapping between these parameters in Yang-Mills theory goes as follows. The Yang-Mills coupling constant squared, the thing that appears in front of the nonlinear terms here, I haven't actually written, I forgot to write them, but here there should perhaps be G Yang-Mills squared, is just simply related to the string coupling constant like this. And the N that appears here is the N in the SUN gauge symmetry of the Yang-Mills theory. Now, this duality, first of all, is a conjecture. There's no theorem that says the two sides of this duality are indeed equal to each other. There is some evidence to support it. Part of the evidence comes from the symmetries on both sides being the same. Not only are the symmetries are the same, but the multiplets of the symmetry algebras that the important objects fall into turn out to be the same. And there's actually some other checks on the duality. Here I've written it in the column called evidence, like some mapping of computations of correlators of operators, symmetry, non-perturbative symmetries like S-duality. There's some calculations of Wilson loops that match rather well on both sides of the correspondence, and so on. One problem with checking this correspondence is these are still both difficult nonlinear interacting theories that you can't solve exactly. In fact, you can only solve them in certain limits. The Yang-Mills theory you can solve perturbatively in an asymptotic expansion in its coupling constant. The string theory on this curved background you can't solve exactly either. In fact, you can't even solve non-interacting string theory, the spectrum of the free string with g-string turned off on this background. What you can solve is the low energy limit of the string, non-interacting string theory, which is basically supergravity. Okay, so you can only solve each theory in a particular limit. In fact, this supergravity limit one can use to get some information about the gauge theory. And in the original ADS-CFT, the Maldacena conjecture, this was the limit that gave all of the excitement. The fact that you could take a limit of the string theory, which is classical supergravity, you could compute something there, and then you could ask, what are you computing in Yang-Mills theory? And the turns out the things that you were computing in Yang-Mills theory were correlation functions or other things in a certain double limit. That double limit was obtained as follows. First, one takes the so-called large N Tuft limit of the Yang-Mills theory. So you put N, the rank of the gauge group, to infinity, and the Yang-Mills coupling constant to zero in such a way that this combination called the Tuft coupling is held fixed. And then after you do that, you take the limit as this Tuft coupling is large. So that's the limit of the Yang-Mills theory that corresponds to classical supergravity. So the amazing thing about this was one could use classical supergravity computations then to compute things that appear deep in the quantum regime of the Yang-Mills theory. If you think of which Feynman diagrams contribute to some amplitude in this limit, there are first of all the Feynman diagrams which are projected out by the Tuft limit, that is the planar diagrams, ones that can be drawn on a plane without crossing any lines. And then if lambda is large, it's the maximally complicated planar diagrams, you know, the ones with maximal numbers of the non-perturbative ones in a sense. Okay, what I want to talk about here, though, is a slightly different limit of ADS-CFT. So it's not going to be the supergravity limit. It will be a large N limit, which is small curvature, but it's done a little bit differently. In terms of geometry, on ADS5 cross S5, it's called the PP wave limit, or the Penrose limit. Taking the limit proceeds as something like as follows. What you do is you first select a null geodesic on this spacetime. The particular null geodesic we're interested in is a geodesic that's given as follows. We think of sitting at one point, well, one spatial point, actually, on a world line that evolves in the time direction on ADS5. And all of the spatial motion is on the 5 sphere. And that motion is basically circulating at the speed of light around an equator of the 5 sphere. And then what you do is you look at a neighborhood of that geodesic, and you basically pretend that neighborhood is the whole space by appropriate scaling of the coordinates. So you blow up this neighborhood, and you get a spacetime, which is called the parallel plane wave spacetime, actually a special case of parallel plane wave spacetime. So the scaling goes something like as follows. If you coordinatize this distance along an equator of the 5 sphere by psi, and time in ADS5 by t, then you look at these light cone coordinates, x plus and x minus, which are some combinations of t and psi. And then I've already anticipated I'm going to scale x minus. And here I'm just using r, the radius of curvature of the space, as a scaling. And then I'll take r to infinity later. So this is already emphasizing x minus over x plus. And then to blow up this region, you also scale the other coordinates accordingly. Then in the limit as r goes to infinity, this ADS5 cross S5 metric reduces to this thing. And this metric you'll recognize as having two copies of R4, right, to make 8 of the dimensions. And then the other 2 of the 10 dimensions are here in the x plus x minus coordinates. This is an ordinary Minkowskian piece, and the only piece that deviates from Minkowski space is sitting here. It has the total radius of this in this 8-dimensional space squared in front of dx plus dx plus. Okay, so this is a particular limit of the background geometry. And in this limit, the Ramond-Ramond 4 form, that's, or d of a 4, has two components which survive, which look something like this. And there might be a minus sign here, I don't remember.
How is the mu related to the original?
Mu, in a sense, is a parameter here. You can change mu just by rescaling x plus and x minus in the opposite ways. So mu appears here because there's plus here, I guess. So in a sense, it's a parameter of the limit. So we take this limit, a new parameter appears. And in some sense, it has to do with the Lorentz frame in this x plus, x minus direction that you took the limit in.
The omega 3 tilde is on S5, is it?
The omega 3 tilde is some 3-sphere embedded in S5. That's right. And this one is a 3-sphere embedded in ADS5. Yeah.
One way or another, mu should be related to n or not.
No. It's just a parameter here. We'll see free parameters emerge on the Yang-Mills side, too.
Is the strength of the 5 form, which it was dependent on n?
Yeah, it used to be quantized. It used to be dependent on n, but that goes away in the limit. Okay. You can see one problem emerging for doing ADS-CFT right away. That's because in ADS-CFT you had this very nice holographic idea that in a sense ADS had a four-dimensional surface and in some sense the Yang-Mills theory lived on that surface. It's not very precise because where you are exactly, where the Yang-Mills operators are exactly on the 10-dimensional space has to do with their energy scale. But at least in some sense, there was a notion of holography, that the Yang-Mills theory lived on the surface of the space. Here we've done violence to the surface, in a sense, that we've just cut it out. We've looked at a small neighborhood here and around basically a world line. I guess I should have drawn this as a line. And we've chopped that piece out and pretended it's a whole space. So the surface is gone. So we've lost a little bit of holography. But on the other hand, all we have done is taken some kind of limit of the type of the background on which the type 2B superstring lives. We focused on some region in the space. So we should still be able to identify the Yang-Mills operators, which in a sense correspond to excitations that live near this null geodesic. Well, at least in principle. The fact that we can do it in practice is, to me, still amazing. But at least in principle, we could think of doing that. There should be some Yang-Mills operators which correspond to states in the Yang-Mills theory because of operator-state correspondence, and then correspond to states in the string theory because of the duality. And there should be some states in the string theory where the energy of the state or whatever attributes a state has are somehow localized in that region of the space. And so when we've blown up that region, we should still have those states. And we should be able to ask, what are they in the Yang-Mills theory, on the Yang-Mills side? And what are their properties? And we should still, in a sense, have a Yang-Mills dual of the string theory in that region. So in some ways, we've truncated the string theory. We've chopped out excitations that lived almost everywhere and just kept some of them, still a lot of them, but some. And we'll do the same kind of truncation of the Yang-Mills theory and ask about duality there. It's quite a non-trivial check on ADS-CFT to ask this, as we'll see by looking at the limit of Yang-Mills theory that we have to take. It's no longer the same as the supergravity limit. Before I do that, let me pause to say what's so nice about this PP wave background. Well, the nice thing about it is you can actually solve non-interacting string theory there. If you go, the PP wave background, remember, only had this sort of non-trivial piece in the metric. The rest is Minkowski space. You can solve non-interacting string theory on Minkowski space, no problem. If you have this extra piece, you can, in the light cone gauge, actually solve for the spectrum of this string theory. So you know the spectrum of the free string. The reason why you can do this in the light cone gauge is because these derivatives of x plus, well, in the light cone gauge, you can choose x plus to be proportional to the world sheet time. So the derivative of x plus turns into a constant, basically given by p plus. So what the world sheet theory looks like is, for the bosonic part, a bunch of massive scalar fields living on the world sheet. And so you can compute the spectrum, and you can do it for the fermionic components in the case of the superstring, too. And in fact, one should, because the bosonic string, in order to have a conformal invariant theory, which you're sort of guaranteed of if you keep everything, because you sort of took a limit of a conformally invariant theory, that only happens for the type 2 superstring, and only when you keep the Ramond-Ramond flux and things like that properly. So that's the one that makes sense here. And this was all worked out by Mitsayev in some very nice work before Maldacena and collaborators did their stuff, and elaborated then later on by Mitsayev and Saitlin. Okay, so you can actually solve string theory there, and you can calculate the spectrum of a free string. And for example, if you look at the first excitations of a string, what do they look like? Well, the spectrum, here I've written in terms of these quantities, which I'll have to tell you what they are later, but in a sense, the energy spectrum of the string, now this is the mass of scalar field, so it goes like square root of mass squared plus momentum squared. In a sense, the momenta are also quantized, and one can do the computation and look something like this. Note that G string here isn't actually zero. In a sense, G string is still turned on. N has been put to infinity, And in fact, what I'm going to try and show you on the Yang-Mills side is this makes sense when n and j squared are scaled in such a way that n over j squared is a finite constant. And g string is just an arbitrary parameter. And in a sense, then you can see two parameters emerging here, n over j squared and g string as two independent parameters, which we'll find in this limit. But in any case, one can produce the string spectrum. It's an energy spectrum. One can then go over to the Yang-Mills side and say, can we find operators which have the same spectrum?
Is creation operator working on vacuum or on the chiral primary?
On the vacuum. The vacuum is the chiral primary. It comes from the geometry. I haven't told you about a few things here. Remember, the radius of the space had g string times n in it. I did my scaling argument just using the radius, so in some sense it canceled there, but I shouldn't have quite done that. Right? I should have used something called j squared, and then you would have had this ratio. So
let me get the geometry. H plus and H minus are a coordinate on the sphere. Alright?
X plus and X minus are space time. You mean this X plus and this X minus?
Yeah.
Space time light cone coordinates. They're not on the sphere, no.
They're not on the sphere.
No.
You have something called small x plus, small x minus on psi minus e, psi plus d.
Yeah. It was on the sphere, but I took a limit, remember, and the sphere kind of unwound.
Yeah, but is this still on that thing?
Yeah.
And the x transpose is on what?
X transpose is all of the transverse things. So remember, I took a light cone direction, which was time on the ADS side, and then this equator coordinate on the sphere. So x plus and x minus were made out of those.
So all ADS coordinates are fixed except time?
Yes.
Okay.
They're fixed except time, and then you take sort of quadratic fluctuations of them, and they're in here, right? So you can think of it as a sort of quadratic approximation to the ADS metric, actually, around some geodesic.
So your state has a label J or delta or something like that. So it's a chiral primary with delta and J.
Yeah. I'll explain where these come from in a minute. I'll show you on the Yang-Mills side. What's happening here is the energy on the string side you should identify with the dilatation quantum number on the Yang-Mills side. So that's why delta has snuck in here a little too early. But okay. Okay, on the Yang-Mills side, what do you do? Well, here, like I have already told you, there isn't really a notion of holography. So the most direct way to look at the Yang-Mills side is just to identify the observables and see what sort of limit that you're taking in terms of the appropriate quantum numbers of states. So the appropriate identification of energy, or the time direction killing vector on ADS5 on the Yang-Mills side, is actually the dilatation charge, which turns into the dimension of operators. And the angular momentum around the equator of the phi sphere is a flavor quantum number in Yang-Mills, called J. Okay, it's part of the SO6 R symmetry group. And then you can make P plus and P minus, and they turn out to be these two combinations of things when you actually take the appropriate scaling of these spatial variables. So P plus is delta minus J, P minus is this thing. And what you want to do is take a limit of the theory where P plus and P minus stay finite as R goes, as the radius of curvature goes to infinity, which I think that's right. Okay, so the appropriate states will have delta and J going to infinity, if P minus is going to be non-zero, in such a way that delta minus J is a finite number. So that means you should look at states in the Yang-Mills theory that have very high scaling dimension, delta, very large scaling dimension, a very large charge in some U1 subgroup of the SO6 R symmetry, in such a way that this difference of quantum numbers is something finite, but each of these goes to zero, like, or to infinity, like R squared. And remember, R squared was given by this in terms of Yang-Mills constants by the square root of G Yang-Mills squared n, the Tuft coupling. Okay, so that limit in terms of parameters turns out to be something like this. You like J over R squared to remain finite. Delta over R squared to remain finite. J over R squared remaining finite. Well, this, if you square it, is actually J squared over G Yang-Mills squared n. The limit I'll talk about will actually keep G Yang-Mills squared finite and take the limit as J and n goes to infinity, so J squared over n is fixed. Okay, so one should identify states that behave this way. Well, that's not an entirely easy thing to do. The reason is we're taking n to infinity, but keeping the Yang-Mills coupling constant finite. In the Tuft limit, you always put the Yang-Mills coupling constant to zero so that the Tuft coupling remains finite. The reason for that is that Feynman diagrams tend to grow with n. In fact, if you look at the large n limit of Yang-Mills theory and calculate something like a vacuum energy, you see order by order, the vacuum energy will be proportional to n to the power of the number of index loops in a fat graph expansion. The more complicated the Feynman diagram, the higher the powers in n. In fact, what's usually done, of course, for planar graphs like this is you combine n with G Yang-Mills squared and keep that constant, and then the diagrams all go like n squared. And in fact, if you take non-planar graphs, they're suppressed by powers of n squared compared to the leading one, or something like that. So you get a kind of a topological expansion in the end. You can see that if one takes n to infinity and doesn't put G Yang-Mills to zero, all kinds of things are going to be blowing up everywhere. These perturbative calculations for general operators aren't going to make much sense. The idea here is to identify a set of operators for which this kind of calculation does make sense. The candidate for operators, the appropriate operators, are operators that are protected or almost protected by supersymmetry. There is one special set of operators which is protected from getting quantum corrections at all by the large degree of supersymmetry in n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. Those are the so-called chiral primary operators. What they are is if you take a local product of a bunch of the scalar fields, so I1, I2 up to IK are the isospin indices, and take a symmetrized and trace, take this symmetrized and traceless in those isospin indices. This is called a chiral primary operator. This operator has very nice properties under renormalization. In fact, its two-point function and three-point functions don't renormalize at all. That means that its anomalous dimension is given exactly by its tree-level dimension. So if there are k scalar fields here, each one has dimension 1, and delta equals k for this operator. One could also choose these indices in such a way that it had a U1 charge equal to the number of operators there, which is j. The way you do that is you consider a complex combination of two of the fields, The U1 quantum number called J is the one that rotates, say, phi 1 into phi 2. And then just take J powers of that operator. So here is an operator for which delta equals J. And that is actually an exact statement, true to all orders in perturbation theory. So this, in a sense, one identifies as the ground state of the string theory sigma model on the PP wave background. So this is an operator which you can identify with a state, because this is a conformal field theory, and then you identify with a state of the string theory, which is that ground state. There's another one, similar operator, which is protected, that you can get by doing an isospin rotation in, say, the 2-3 plane that injects a phi 3 into this trace. Okay, that has delta minus J equals 1. This operator is still a chiral primary operator, so is protected from renormalization. So delta minus J equals 1 is an exact statement. These are also some of the states in the string spectrum corresponding to the low-lying modes of the supergraviton, which are also, in some sense, protected by supersymmetry on the string side. Then you could do this sort of rotation twice and get a state like this, which is delta minus J equals 2. And you could just keep on that way. And you could generate a whole bunch of states that have delta minus J, first of all, protected, small, and then you could think of taking the large J limit. In all of these cases, delta is slightly bigger than J and stays finite. So these, you think, are some of the operators which correspond to string states. Okay, what about ones with some non-trivial piece of the spectrum? Well, these were actually identified initially by Berenstein, Maldacena, and Nastassi. And the idea there was we could stay close to this class of protected operators by, in a sense, messing up the fact that it's a chiral primary by sticking in some phases. And these phases should be small as J gets large. So on the previous slide, I had a kind of something which was a double isospin rotation of a chiral primary field, which inserted two fields like this. And it was summed over flatly from P equals 0 to J without this phase. That was a chiral primary field that doesn't renormalize. Now you stick in this phase. For large J, this phase is a very small amplitude thing. And in a sense, the operator that you get is close to or an almost protected operator. So this should have some quantum corrections. The quantum corrections, at one loop, you'd expect to go like G Yang mil squared n, the quantum corrections to delta. But in the large J limit, in a sense, you can expand this phase, and you'll get something like 1 over J squared. So the parameter which governs the correction will be G Yang mil squared n over J squared, which is a combination of stuff that's staying finite. So the 1 over J squared that you get protects you from the factors of n that you get when you put n to infinity that come from index loops. Okay, so that's the idea. And so one can do the computation of the spectrum of this operator by computing its anomalous dimension. So Berenstein, Maldacena, and Nastassi did the computation up to leading order, and what they found is amazing agreement with string theory. This thing is the leading order in the expansion of that square root I showed you a few slides ago that appears in the spectrum of the sort of string states that are excited by two creation operators. And in fact, we computed non-planar corrections, and so did some of the other collaborators, some of our competitors. Actually, we got the wrong result, first of all. We thought that they vanished. That turned out to be wrong. They don't vanish. They also had the wrong result. In fact, no one's quite sure even yet what the right result is, although we're fairly sure the one that's now in version 2 of our paper is correct. It differs from the other guys up to some factors, first of all, a minus sign and factors a 2. Yeah?
Is this computation then the same limit in which the supergravity description is valid?
No. That's because G. Yang Mills is still turned on here. So it's not supergravity. In fact, the string spectrum is really there. Right? The ends give the sort of string levels. So right, the supergravity limit decouples all of the higher string levels.
So what is the argument why when you act with this creation operators, this A3 and A4, that you didn't get just the pure chiral primary, but together with the phase?
Well, because a pure chiral primary is a zero mode in a sense, something protected by supersymmetry, right? Where as those fields, their spectrum depends on G string and therefore G Yang Mills, so it can't be a chiral primary.
Yeah, right? That's clear. Right? Why is it exactly this guy? Or only the actual computation?
It's a lucky guess that it's exactly this guy. In fact, in the end, it isn't exactly this guy. It is in the planar limit. So if you only consider planar diagrams on the Yang-Mills side, or free string theory, there it appears that it's exactly this guy, for reasons which I really don't know. I mean, it's the simplest guess. It seems to work. Can't think of any other operator. So maybe that's enough. When you go beyond the planar limit, so turn on J squared over N, which somehow seems to govern string interactions here. One can actually do this calculation, which is, in a sense, a string field theory correction to this leading order spectrum. There's actually operator mixing. So this result I've written here isn't quite right. One should actually diagonalize mixing between single trace and double trace operators. Things get pretty messy and really hasn't been ironed out to this day exactly what you're supposed to do. But what is amazing, actually, there's something else, that when you turn on J squared over N, the non-planar diagrams, as I'll argue for you in a moment, just the leading term, with G Yang Mills equals zero, it's written as 2 here, but there's more to it than that, even it becomes non-diagonal between these operators, and you have to diagonalize things. And what I've written here is the eigenvalues of the resulting matrix for delta. So you get mixing of operators even before you have Yang-Mills interactions. Okay, let me elaborate a little bit. So what we're computing here is the anomalous dimensions of operators. Let me go back to the simpler case of the ground state. So not these BMN operators, but just the chiral primary operators. Okay, so here delta equals J. End of story. It's a ground state. Delta equals J, delta minus J is zero. It's a zero energy state, the ground state of the sigma model, the simplest string, string mode, and so on. But there's still something interesting you can compute about this operator. And that's its normalization, the normalization of the state. Now, really, in quantum mechanics, normalization of a state isn't very interesting. But still here, it will have something to do with operator mixing later on. So let me describe this kind of calculation. What I want to do here is calculate the normalization of the state, which is stuck in this function of n and j, as a function of n and j, and then take the scaling limit, which is n goes to infinity and j goes to infinity in such a way that j squared over n is finite. And just ask, what does that limit look like? Notice here that limit is a little bit strange in that I do not know what to do with the space-time structure here. Right, if taken out this factor of 1 over x squared to the power j, as j goes to infinity, that's a fairly disgusting distribution. So the philosophy right now is to forget about this and think of this function as a normalization of the state, and it's already interesting enough. And the fact that I have to forget about this says something about the fact that I've lost holography. Somehow the space-time dependence in the Yang-Mills theory doesn't seem to be translatable to any information on the string side. Okay, so let's compute this function. So in the planar limit, if I'm only interested in planar diagrams, I do the computation as follows. You can think of this as kind of an annulus amplitude. Here's trace z to the j of x. I guess I forgot the right trace here. I'll have to fix it. So you can think of that as a circle or a hole in the space, a boundary of the space, which is emitting j of these z lines. And then trace z bar to the j at zero means that there should be a similar thing which absorbs j lines over here. In the planar limit, it's pretty easy to count the diagrams. If you take the first line going across, it could connect to any of the J entry ports. You could think of this as two towns. I don't know, Vancouver, Seattle. So everyone's leaving Vancouver and going to Seattle. J exit ports and J entry ports. In fact, we're going to take the large J limit eventually. The first guy, he has J choices where to enter. The second guys aren't allowed to cross his driving lane, so to speak, so his choices are all fixed, and so the multiplicity of diagrams is just J. And then if you count the number of index loops, it's actually n to the J. So this function in the limit of planar diagrams looks like that. So how about non-planar diagrams? Actually, I like to think of this problem as something like building highways. So I'm a building contractor, and I've been contracted to build highways from Vancouver to Seattle. All right, so I get I'm allowed J lanes, and J is going to be large after a while. So I build my J lanes, and I send the bill to the government, and they say, "Well, wait a minute, you build me for J highways, but that's really only one highway with a lot of lanes." So I get clever. I have to think of a way to make more than one highway or I'm not going to profit from this enterprise. So what do? I invent the overpass. Once I put an overpass, then clearly these are distinguished in some way. They're not just lanes on the same highway. In fact, here there are three different highways. And in fact, I can ask how many highways are there? How many ways of making different highways are there? And how many ways are there of distributing J lanes between them? And of course, this now has a toroidal topology and should give the next leading order in the large N expansion. The number of ways of building these highways should give this coefficient. And the main question here is in the scaling limit I eventually want to take, which is J and N going to infinity, so that J squared over N is finite, do these non-planar diagrams survive or not? Do they survive? Are they finite or are they zero? Three possibilities. Okay, well, you can see there are at least three ways to do this. There's actually a fourth one, which I didn't draw here. If you go, say, go between these two, come back over the overpass, I know it's kind of inefficient, and then go under here, there's a fourth one, and indeed with one overpass there are four different ways of making highways, so I should distribute these J lines between these four. That means I should produce a partition of these J exit ports into four subsets. There are J choose four such partitions. J choose 4, as J gets large, looks like J to the 4th. So I'm going to have something times J to the 4th here, which is exactly balanced to survive my scaling limit. It doesn't grow too fast. It doesn't grow too slowly. In fact, it's exactly what survives. Well, to do it properly on a torus, I've sort of unwound it. You can actually take J choose 4 is still on a torus if there are only three highways, so you should add these together. The J choose 3 is subleading. These add together to this, and this comes out the J to the 4th over 4 factorial. In fact, in this simple case, one can get all genera. The way you do that is by recognizing that this is just a correlator in an old-fashioned complex matrix model, not a very simple matrix model in spite of its Gaussian form. It's because it's really a two-matrix model, and you're looking at complicated correlators. But this can actually be integrated using some group theory, and the result is this. And this nice result tells you, with any number of overpasses, how many highways you can build. Right, simply by asymptotic expansion of it in 1 over n. So, for example, for genus 2, you know about genus 2 if you build 5 highways, otherwise you can throw away one of the overpasses if there's less than 5. Or you could build 6, 7, or as many as 8 highways. 8 highways you can build in 21 different ways, and you can distribute the lanes in J choose 8, and so on. You can get higher orders from this. If you take the scaling limit, only the maximum number of highways survives, and in fact you can sum up the scaling limit and find the normalization of this ground state in that limit to be something that's a hyperbolic sign. And you can see a new parameter is appearing in the scaling limit that somehow is governing the fluctuations in topology. In fact, if you look at what's happening here in the scaling limit, at every order, the thing with the maximum number of making highways is surviving. So in a sense, you have stuff coming out of here and into here. And in the limit where there is an infinite number of lanes, in a sense, you're wrapping all of the homology cycles of the Riemann surface that you're drawing them on in such a way that you're, first of all, making use of them in a maximal way, and then the generic one will have an infinite number of lines going everywhere. So in a way, you're painting this whole Riemann surface with lines. And that's the way in which this limit is stringy. And then what you're computing here is truly the two-loop string amplitude computation for normalization of this state. Now, the string theory, that's a rather trivial thing because it's just normalization of a state, but it is still indeed two loops. And the amazing thing about it is it's two loops with the string coupling turned off. And here the coupling constant is really J squared over M.
So all genera contribute, but then only some most common diagrams contribute.
All genera contribute. The diagrams that are emphasized are the ones that wrap the homology generators with fat strings, as fat as possible. Okay, well, one can do a similar thing for correlators of these BMN operators. So these are the operators which had two impurities inserted in these phases, which are characterized by some momenta M and N. And already with G string turned off, one can do a similar thing. So there you have these two towns, and there are two marked roads in between them that you're not allowed to cross. And then you basically ask the same questions. To the leading order, things are nice and diagonal. And then already, at the first non-planar order, there's some rather complicated matrix mixing those operators. And the matrix I've written here, it looks something like this. Notice how non-analytic it is in M and N. It's actually really surprising. This led us to great difficulties early on because we'd find some elements of the matrix and assume it was somehow going to be analytic in N and extrapolate, and it really isn't. It's really different in all these cases. Hey, but in any sense, there's some matrix that mixes these operators. So already with G string turned off, if you consider non-planar diagrams, the BMN operator itself, the pure operator, doesn't create a state with well-defined conformal dimension. You have to actually diagonalize this matrix to find states with well-defined conformal dimensions. Okay. Okay, well, there's other calculations you can do, even with G-string turned off. For example, one can calculate three-point functions. So, for example, a three-point function of these operators. So this is something that is actually also protected by no renormalization theorems. So the result of this computation is good to all orders in perturbation theory. There's something to do with the three graviton vertex, well, the three scalar vertex, whatever this lowest mode of the string theory corresponds to. I think it's actually sort of a scalar field. And one can compute it, and it comes out, this is in the scaling limit where J, K, and L all become large and are of order the square root of n, and you simply get some function like this. And there's many other three-point functions one can compute, and so on. Okay, well, maybe I'm ending early on you. So let me tell you something about conclusions. Okay, well, the success of at least the naive planar computation of the anomalous dimension of BMN operators, the fact that it reproduces the string spectrum, at least to the same order and expansion in G-Yang Mills. Actually, there are arguments that it reproduces at the higher orders. Gross and collaborators went to two loops, and they claim even higher orders appear somewhere in their paper, and there's a paper by Daniela Zenon and collaborator, which also gives arguments to all orders, that actually you can compute at all orders and really reproduce the square root of G-Yang Mills squared and stuff. The fact that that succeeds at the planar level is already something amazing. In a sense, it's a highly non-trivial check of ADS-CFT away from the supergravity limit, because it really is a string spectrum now that you're computing. In a sense, one has figured out what the holographic dual of strings on this PP wave background is without using holography. One still doesn't really have a holographic picture, but one has a Yang-Mills dual of the theory, at least. Furthermore, the scaling limit that you have to take is an interesting one. It's very similar to this double scaling limit of old matrix models, where you tune several parameters as you put n to infinity to get some interesting behavior. Actually, this is really quite similar in that sense, this appears as a new parameter of the theory. The dictionary for identifying the correct Yang-Mills operators with string states is still in a little bit of flux. The BMN operators in the planar limit seem to be correct for these lower string excitations. But when you include non-planar corrections, it's not clear what's going on anymore. They clearly mix with each other. They mix with multi-trace operators, and the exact dictionary hasn't been worked out. And in fact, it's very unintuitive the way that they mix, because the non-planarity is governed by this constant J squared over N rather than G Yang Mills. In fact, we're working on that right now, on operator mixing. Once that's resolved, in some sense, one has a way here of using Yang-Mills computations to do what is basically a string field theory computation, to get corrections that are string loop corrections to string theory amplitudes and string theory observables from Yang-Mills theory. And that's probably the most exciting part of this, because those, if anyone has experience on the string side, are really difficult calculations that have never been done in any practical way beyond genus 2. And here, in fact, it looks like in some cases you can simply sum all genera. In some cases, it's a fairly straightforward Feynman diagram calculation to calculate higher genus. With that, thank you.